Catherine Tucker. I am a professor at the MIT Sloan School of Management. And my job today is, much like David, to provide some instruction about network effects and how they relate to platforms. And in particular, I am charged with two missions. The first is to go back to introductory economics and talk about what really is a network effect. But I'm going to try and do something a bit interesting and sort of say how it's evolved as industry has evolved too in terms of its definition. And then we're going to go and think, well, how big a problem really are these network effects in these new platform markets, which we just had so ably described. All right, so what is a network effect? It is a phrase which simply describes the value that users obtain from interacting from other users on a platform. One little hint here. Sometimes you hear them called network externalities. Sometimes you hear them called network effects. I prefer the term network effect. Why? Well, a network externality implies that no one is really internalizing the fact this is going on. And if you think what platforms are all about, it's all about internalizing these properties. So I like the term network effects and think of it as simply describing the value we get when we interact with someone else in a marketplace, in a platform. Now, I'm going to take you through different types of network effects. And we're going to start off going back in history, perhaps to the 1970s and some work that was done in telecommunications, and introduce a concept of a direct network effect, which I like to call a same-side network effect. Now, what is this? It's what happens in terms of how I value users on a piece of technology, on a platform, who I interact with in a way which means they're similar to me. So, for example, on something like Skype, it's communication technology. I'm looking largely to communicate to people who look a lot like me. We can also see how network effects operate on communication technologies like Skype. If I am the only person with Skype installed on my computer, I look pretty silly, right? It's not a piece of junk software. The only reason I would install Skype on my computer is in order to communicate with other people. Therefore, I'm going to care about how many other users are also having Skype installed, and that's where we get a network effect. All right, so then we move on to what I like to call cross-side network effects to emphasize the idea that there will be different folks' interaction. And what, you know, maybe 10 years ago we were calling indirect network effects. And we're going to start off there with the sort of classic operating system case of a network effect. So if you take something like Linux, if I am a developer on Linux, I really care about how many people have Linux installed because I only want to make programs if people are actually going to use them. And similarly, when I'm making the decision about whether to install Linux on my computer, I'm going to really care about how many developers are actually developing software for that platform. And so we see a cross-side network effect where really we've got two quite different groups of people who care about the presence of the other group. Now, of course, we're going to remember that kind of case in the 1990s, so let's now move on to what the commissioner so elegantly called marketplaces, which are an incredibly broad brush now of our digital economy. And in these kind of marketplaces, say in the case of eBay, we have network effects too. And why is that? Well, if I am a seller of laser pointers, then I really care about how many people might want to buy that laser pointer. And similarly, if I am wanting to buy that laser pointer. I'm not going to be on eBay unless I think there's a reasonable chance there are going to be people selling it. So again, we can see the work of network effects there. Similarly, if I'm thinking about a ride-sharing application and I am thinking about whether I'm going to install an app, I'm only going to install Uber if I think there are going to be riders out there. And similarly, if I'm a driver, drivers out there, and if I'm a driver, you know, no point driving for Uber unless I'm going to be able to pick up a passenger. Now, in terms of definitions, you know, we were told to do our best with definitions. And what I always think about a platform is that a big problem with them is that, in some sense, everything sort of wants to be a platform. And I experienced this. The material you're seeing today is actually coming from the class I teach on platforms at MIT. And the first time I taught it, I made the mistake of putting up a slide of the top 50 brands, trying to inspire my students and saying, look how many of them are platforms. I looked at it and I said, oh, but Coca-Cola, not a platform, I guess. McDonald's, not a platform. You know, but look at that top line. Everything else is sort of like working towards being a platform. And at that point, I had someone stick up their hand in a huge, furious rage. And they said, how dare you say that Coca-Cola and McDonald's are not platforms? I consult for both those companies. If you said that to their management, they would just be so insulted. How dare you? And I sort of looked at him. He looked at me. And I tried to find out why on earth he thought that McDonald's or Coca-Cola could be platforms. He came up with some sort of random story about Coca-Cola awards in the bottle tops. I didn't find it convincing then. I don't find it convincing now. But the key thing to take from this is it's definitely hard because everyone's trying to be a platform, you know, especially in business, and they like to sort of bring forward this platform terminology, which is something I would struggle with. What I think is more useful is thinking about when things really are platforms rather than just sort of thinking about bottle tops, what challenges do they face and what changes? The first challenge is that because we're dealing with network effects, which are all about valuing interactions with other users, it means that your first job as a platform is to make sure you have people on your platform. And this is what David called the critical mass challenge, and we're going to be talking about that in a bit. The second challenge is something we call, when we're teaching platform strategy, coring. And coring is the idea that you have to set up rules and regulations on your platform to make sure that not only do you have participants there, but when they're there, they behave well. This means you have to act as a police, you have to act as a mini government of that platform. And I was just so happy to hear the commissioner in his speech really pick up on this fact. Because for me, this is one of the most interesting parts of a platform. If you look at the academic literature, it's really changed from being all about just network effects to even thinking about how we can best set up these rules and regulations on platforms to make these interactions go well. And it was just really happy to hear sort of recognition that, yes, we would expect this to exist. And what we need to do really, as well as sort of thinking of it as suspicious, is instead to work out, well, is this benefiting consumers in the way we would hope, given the idea of this kind of policy is to make sure people behave well. All right, so now we're going to turn to the second act, which is thinking about network effects as a potential barrier to entry. And here I must admit I cheated a bit in that, as I say, I teach this platforms class. And what we do there is I help firms who are starting up platforms work out how to break into platform markets. And so I was thinking, well, those strategies are going to be very useful for thinking about whether or not you're going to be able to break into a platform market or not. Now, to do this, I always use this equation to try and remind my students to think about, well, what is the right way of analyzing how customers behave when they're thinking about whether to adopt a certain platform or another. And all this says is the network benefits, those are the benefits I get from network effects, plus the standalone benefits must be greater than the net price I'm paying. Now, this is going to be a useful tool. I think it helps us not only analyze barriers to entry, but you can immediately see the chicken and egg problem that David described in this equation. In that, if I'm a newcomer, I'm an entrant, and I want to break in this market, grab customers, and I'm competing with an existing platform, then I have a problem. In that I don't have any network benefits, they, by just sheer virtue of their size, have these network benefits. So how am I ever going to break into this kind of market as a tiny firm? Now, the good news is it's actually less chicken and eggy most of the time than you might think, and there's some, well, you know, reasonable ways, or we believe the reasonable reasons to believe that actually it's not the big barrier to entry you might think. And what I always do to decompose this is to say, well, really, how strong are those network effects that you're worrying about curtailing your ability to enter? And I identify, this comes from my research, three different drivers of the strength of network effects. Now, the first driver is that in early theory models, and also in early empirical applications, there was always an inbuilt assumption that network effects were just a function of N. That is the total number of people using the platform. And if you believe that, then my gosh, that means that network effects can be quite a sizable potential barrier to entry. However, in reality, what I found, and this sort of comes from my dissertation, which is a very long time ago, where I looked to see, really, is that how network effects behave? And there I was studying people using a video messaging system. And what was really noticeable was just the fact that when people were thinking about whether or not to adopt this particular platform, they didn't care about the complete size of the network of people using it. Instead, they were just focused on the few individuals that they knew they would be communicating with. And that suggests that network effects can be very localized and therefore potentially a little bit more fragile than we sometimes believe. We can see that playing out in platforms too. If I want to use this kind of website which brings together schools and parents, well then, you know what? I'm not going to give up my job at MIT. I'm not moving. I'm only going to be caring about schools in the local area. Whatever happens in Washington State, I'm pleased for them, but it's not going to affect my decision about what website to use. So I think then the question comes, well, given this, when might we actually think that network effects could be a function of the entire size of the platform rather than these small little clusters of behavior? And I always think a sort of good edge case for this is thinking about a genetic database style of platform. Well, there potentially, because you're searching for the proverbial needle in the haystack, as a researcher perhaps trying to develop new pharmaceuticals, then I'm going to want to just have as access to as many, many patient histories as possible. And if I'm a patient knowing that with a rare disease, knowing that I am facing a needle in the haystack type search processor, I'm going to be looking for the database where there are going to be the most researchers, because it's not clear where any kind of genetic cure may come from. So there we can make an argument that network effects may be a function of sheer size. But I want you to notice that in some sense, the reason that size is so important there is because people are not clear or not certain about who they want to interact with. And I think one of the most fundamental drivers of how large the scope of network effects is just certainty over interactions and whether or not users want the option value potentially of being able to communicate or interact with everyone else, people they don't know they want to interact with yet. And we can see this a little bit with social networks, and in particular, the demise of certain social networks. One of the most stunning ones I've ever seen is this social network called Friends United. It was, like many social networks, this was based in the UK, but in 2005, it was bought for vast amounts of money by a major UK TV company. It was described as the crown jewels of that TV company. Everyone was very excited about it. Within 6 months, it was completely dead, despite everyone in the UK basically using it. And if you go through its carcass, which is still there on the internet, what you end up seeing is that just people posted on it, we've gone to Facebook. Because everyone knew each other, they were like, oh, my friends are on Facebook. They went. It was that swift, that easy to coordinate off it. So I think the problem with these localized networks for thinking about them as the reason they don't tend to act so much as a barrier to entry is as soon as you've got a localized network, then it becomes more easy to coordinate and switch between different platforms. So this is going to bring us to the second thing, which is going to be important for the strength of network effects, which is multi-homing. Now, David's already sort of brought this up and said that we're going to discuss it later, so maybe I'm going to do something similar. But I do want to just make this point that much like with earlier, I think, antitrust issues, so much when you're analyzing the strength of network effects as a potential barrier to entry comes from this simple question of, is it the case that our users multi-home? And so, you know, this is one of my favorite examples. I always find it amazing every time you get an Uber or Lyft, you just see the drivers be completely clear. We are multi-homing. We've got no loyalty to any one platform. And when you see that kind of pattern, as someone who loves competition, your heart should just sing. And I do also want to, the other sort of point is, why is this possible? Why do we see so much more multi-homing now in this age than we did, say, in the 1990s era of Microsoft? And I think a lot of it comes from the shift of computing away from being embedded on certain devices towards the cloud, which just makes porting your data, porting your identity across different platforms just so much more easy than it used to be. Last thing just to say in terms of the size of network effects is that we always sort of say it's going to worry that network effects may increase just in size, which could cause competitive concerns. I just want to point out there can be negative network effects too. I'll just tell you that as part of, I'm one of the co-founders of the Crypto Economics Lab at MIT, and one of our biggest successes at it, well, I say success, this is inverted commas, with that lab was we managed to make Bitcoin uncool at MIT. How did we do that? Well, we decided to give $100 in Bitcoin to everyone. And why did that make Bitcoin uncool? Well, all my cool techie people, techie undergraduates, suddenly saw that all the humanities undergraduates now had Bitcoin. That didn't make it cool anymore. That made it too mainstream, too not at the edge. And as a result, they ended up selling those $100 in Bitcoin. You know what? That was in 2014. Do a quick bit of math to work out how much money they lost because we made Bitcoin uncool. Anyway, key point is that we always think you want to have everyone on the platform. Sometimes you really don't. These social and behavioral interactions are incredibly important. Now, we don't have much time for this, but just to say, of course, there are other ways of getting in. You can do something as simple as Instagram did, which is to tweak with standalone benefits. Think about Instagram when they entered that photo sharing market. They were facing these huge platforms such as Flickr at the time. How did they get in? Simply by understanding that 17-year-olds like the idea of Polaroid pictures, right? So we can also use standalone benefits as ways of getting around network effects too. All right. So let me come to the punchline as they're waving red signs at me and say this. First of all, you know, I was told to give a talk about network effects, but I am so glad that the commissioner made the important point that really when you look at platform market, it's not just about network effects. It's also about coring and understanding these rules and regulations to make interactions go well and making sure that they are indeed there to make sure that interactions go well. We often think of network effects potentially as a source of barrier to entry because we're worried that big size reinforces size. But, you know, I've given you three reasons to be slightly worried about that contention, in that generally network effects tend to be a lot smaller in scope than we might think. They tend to be very local. They tend to be undermined by multi-homing. And they tend to be undermined by behavioral impulses. The last thing just to say on an even more optimistic note is that we should be glad that in 2018, digitization has facilitated multi-homing, intensifying competition. And I still think that whenever we're thinking about these platforms and barriers to entry, the right question is really still ones of multi-homing versus single-homing and switching costs. So I'll just say thank you.